Hello, I'm Simon Burton, and you're listening to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105, an hour in which we'll explore the art of murder mystery crime writing, hear how Shakespeare and his ghosts can deliver tantalising clues and coded messages, take a look at playful art grounded in reality outside cyberspace, and hear about a new arts club that's making waves. In this edition, artist Nicola Powers introduces her work at her new exhibition, Material Wealth at Williams Art. Cambridge author Jill Peyton Walsh talks on being a crime novelist and the task of continuing the work of Dorothy Sayers featuring gentleman sleuth Lord Peter Wimsey. We investigate creative cabaret filling an entertainment niche in the Grad Pad with Lucy Alexander. And local playwright Ronnie Drew talks on celebrating Shakespeare's 450th birthday with a street performance of her play trilogy Shakespeare Reformed. In a world that can be viewed as relentlessly disappearing into virtual reality and cyberspace, fully appreciating authenticity and taking interest in the real world we actually inhabit around us has never been at a lower ebb. I've been talking to an artist who's concerned with keeping people grounded and based in the reality this side of the flickering screen, fully appreciating things that we can touch, smell, explore and experiment with as a source for ideas for powerful artwork. Nicola Powers makes her own materials and likes to paint on things rather than canvases. She's just opened a new exhibition, Material Wealth, at Williams Art in Gwydir Street. Nicola, first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself, because the last time I met you, you were exhibiting in the Museum of Technology. Lots of wonderful work there. Where do you come from in terms of your art? What's your bio?
My training is in glass, actually, from Edinburgh College of Art. I was then moved on to become an animator in London. I worked for various film companies. And I'm a self-trained and self-taught painter, which I did when I moved to Cambridge when I was 30. So I've been painting since I was 30.
And you're currently teaching at Compton Village College?
I am, yes. I was a professional artist for many years, and especially in France. But when I came back from France, I needed to make a bit more of a living, so I became a teacher, and I love it there, actually.
You're someone who does illustrative drawing, obviously your paintings, etc. Tell me about the kind of the source of the materials, first of all, that you use, and where do they come from, and what's the story behind them? Because they're very interesting things, because you sort of paint on things rather than on canvases, don't you?
I do. Well, I do paint on canvas as well, but I have a fear of a white canvas, like many artists, actually, and so I prefer to work on found backgrounds. I love history. I love things that have got a trace or a mark or a footprint from another time or from another person. That inspires the work and the direction that it goes in.
I mean, I notice you've got things like pieces of rough cans of canvas that could have come from anything, basically, some kind of cover for a farm machine or something, with rings and then things behind them with splashes of light that kind of play on the nature of what the objects are. Is that process, juxtaposing things, very important for you?
Very important, very important. The texture for something is very... Like I say, I'm glass trained, so I love light, I love colour. I love transparency. A lot of my work is about transparency painting on the back of glass or acetate, but for this particular show I wanted to focus more on grounded materials. So I've got lead, I've got wood, I wanted to talk about recycling, found stuff, I've got old muslin, I've got a bit of an ironing board in there with linen that's full of splashes. So this is the work that I've got in this particular show is a bit of a departure in that way.
What are the highlights in this exhibition, Material Wealth?
For me personally, I love the three pieces on the arch wall, which are made with found glass tiles put together with wood. There's, like I mentioned before, the ironing board. And lead is one of my favourite materials, lead, from being stained glass and working with glass. I love sheet lead. I love the pattern on it. It's an artwork in itself.
And there's the piece that you're using for your exhibition flyer is something to do with a lunar landing, or
it's basically, so how does this thing happen? You do a sketch in your shed. I'm a colorist. I love color. Actually, I made a piece which is in there as well. I just liked it. It was sitting around for a bit. It goes into your brain. I found a solar panel piece of wood and it looked like the two would go together. So what the piece becomes when you put idea on top of material, it suddenly all comes together. So we've got a moonscape on a solar panel.
It's one thing reacting to another, basically. That's what you look for. And I noticed in your drawings that you have drawings where people are, there's interplay between two people, whether they're blowing clouds of smoke between them. They're enjoying a playful moment, and it's one thing next to another. It's how things interact with each other that interests you.
For me, I always look at the space in between. So it's the space around in between. When you're talking about materials, it's the interaction of material and idea. It's more of that kind of thing that I'm after, rather than a true representation of something.
And what do you aim to do with your art? You want to uplift people, but you want to make them think a little bit, don't you?
I do, definitely. It's a teacher in me.
And being a teacher, I mean, I noticed that enjoying maturity obviously comes through in all of your work. It has that feeling of a mature artistic brain, and yet you spend your time teaching children. Do they actually fuel that in your work? Do you go away from teaching children and go, think, crumbs, you know, I must do this now because of that, as it were?
They absolutely do, in that. So it's a circular thing. I encourage them to play with materials and with paint. Our outcomes are not great, I have to say, but that's where I'm coming from. And then through that process of play, I get inspired to use something that maybe I haven't thought of for a while. I go home and I put my experience onto that, and it happens again.
You've done some great large paintings, like
the one, it's got sort of lots of squirrely.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yes, yes.
That was about, because I thought that one was called Worshipping the Icon, but never mind, there we go. So what that was about, there's a lot of Arabic influence coming through in that mark making. I have done a lot of series of work which is about lettering, which I love, but done in a way that looks almost like an Arabic script, which I also love. I love the decorative aspect of it and the fact it could say something. Worshipping the Icon, that's, again, it's about, you know, why do we? You know, and there could be celebrities as well as religious icons.
And you have things like a figurative nude as well. That, to me, was just a brilliant piece of work. The way that came together, absolutely amazing. And there's another piece called Prostitutes of Warsaw, where you're using light and shade to convey mood and silhouettes and things like that. That's really interesting, because once you have the crib, you know what it's about, then suddenly that whole subject comes across in the work. You must be very proud of that piece.
I love that piece. It's one of my favourites, And it's basically, it's quite flat. It has some collage on it. It has different techniques. Again, that's the kind of thing I love. It's also split into three. It's a triptych, which is very important for me. I do quite a lot of work using the triptych formula. And I really worked on that one. And it was one of those pieces where you just put the last little bit on and you go, oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Now, that doesn't happen very often.
And let's just in the exhibition at Williams Art, you have a large canvas with this sucking material or whatever it is. And then there's a ring right in the middle of the painting that juts out that you could actually sort of put your finger through. That was an interesting touch, because it changes the nature of the work, doesn't it, putting that in.
I often thought I should be a sculptor. I work in a very sculptural way, and I do love the three dimensions of stuff. I'm just trying to still learn how to do the 2D stuff, and then I might move on. But that piece I really love, that's the ring, is the top of a very old postman's bag from France. So the ring is the top, and I've just opened it out and left the ring in, basically. It's a beautiful piece of sacking.
You've got a talk coming up any day now. Can you tell me a bit about what that's going to contain?
Well, it will be, I mean, I am a bit of an evangelist, a teacher in me, and it's about keeping people grounded, keeping them based in reality. The more that we go into screens and virtual and all that kind of stuff, and I see it a lot at school. And so my whole thing is, you know, be aware of what you're walking on, what you're smelling, what you're touching, the pieces that are around you, and that you can actually do something that's quite profound using that stuff that's around. I'm also really mean, and I don't like paying the high prices that you have to pay for art materials. I find it, I just think it's a con. It's a rip-off. I've always made my own paints. I use pigment and oil. I've always made my own gesso. A rabbit skin glue, that's how the big ones held together. And I love the connection with the old techniques from the Middle Ages, the fact that you can take something from the contemporary world and put the two together. And I'll be talking quite a lot about that. And also, there will be an interactive bit.
Sounds absolutely great. And what date is that kicking off? Where is it and what time does it start?
Well, that's going to be at Williams Art in the gallery at 6 o'clock, a week today, Wednesday, which is Wednesday, so it's Wednesday the 30th. Yeah.
So you should go to this exhibition. Nicola Power, thank you very much indeed for spending some time to talk to Cambridge 105.
No problem. Thank you very much.
There's rarely a year that passes in Cambridge's history when something dramatic doesn't happen as a result of an outrageous bet or dare that, if sufficiently witty, eventually enters the prestigious annals of Cambridge urban myth and student legend. Societies and clubs such as the Cambridge Night Climbers Club typify a tradition of doing slightly crazy and forbidden things, like scaling buildings, and at one time positing a loo seat on the top of a King's College Chapel spire. Needless to say, there's often also tragedies as people fall through the ice into the river in winter or misjudge a stunt. Such tales make rich pickings for creative writing, especially if it's in the tradition of murder mystery, as I discovered talking to Cambridge author Jill Peyton Walsh, who, as well as writing her own murder mystery novel set in Cambridge with female sleuth Imogen Quay, also continues the Lord Peter Wimsey series by Dorothy Sayers. Originally a children's writer, she later became a novelist and was awarded the CBE for services to literature. Her character Imogen Quay is a college nurse and fellow of an imaginary St Agatha's College. I caught up with her Cambridge insider world in the novel The Bad Quarto, which begins when a student dare goes wrong and suspected foul play sets off the action.
Why did you take up writing crime and detective stories? Is that because of your love affair with the work of Dorothy Sayers, or was it something that you were into anyway?
I wrote a literary novel which failed to find a British publisher. It found an American publisher. It was called Knowledge of Angels, and it got to the as far as the Booker shortlist. But before that, my husband and I had had to publish it ourselves in this country. So my agent said he didn't think he could sell another literary novel for me had I ever thought of taking to crime. And as people do when they're in a tight corner, I took to crime. And I thought it would be fun. And I based my detective on a real person who was then the neighbour of my second husband in Newnham, and who was a college nurse and who could keep me on the straight and narrow with regards to what college nurses actually did with their time.
St Agatha is somewhere kind of placed somewhere near in the ether, near the back of Magdalen College, isn't it, on Castle Hill?
Yes, I knocked down Shire Hall, which I don't like very much, and put a lovely Jacobean college in its place. I have to say, writing about Cambridge, one of the great pieces of fun is knocking over the buildings you don't like and replacing them with imaginary buildings.
Now, Imogen is an amateur sleuth. This role is not sort of officially appointed to her, is it? It's something that she's sort of fallen into by being given responsibility for students. Is that right?
Yes, she is a deliberately considered detective. Mm. She has advantages. She is, of course, ensconced in the academic world of Cambridge, but she's just an ordinary Cambridge citizen, born and bred, so she's also a town girl, and she has town friends. Furthermore, she has a bit of medical expertise, and she is a deliberate reply from a woman of my generation to all these extraordinary women detectives who broke upon the scene more recently, who can knock over a prize fighter, a tote a gun, date a body by the number of bugs crawling out of it, and are generally aggressively macho. And my detective is more like a golden age detective. She's a good detective because she listens to people, and so she knows more about them than others do. She's a detective using a woman's set of tools, not the kind of pseudo male women detectives which many of my contemporary detective story writers write about. As a viewpoint character, the college nurse is a very interesting and fruitful source of a detective.
Obviously, being someone who lives in Cambridge, you use as a starting point the Cambridge Night Climbing Club, which was basically an organisation where people took fantastic risks to do things like jump the Senate House leap. And notoriously, many people have died doing these things as Cambridge traditions because they've done them when they were drunk or they've done them foolish times.
Or things because like their fathers and grandfathers did it and now they've jolly well got to themselves.
And this story was a story waiting to be written, in my opinion, because there are so many stories like that in Cambridge. And I expect as a writer, you probably know lots of them, don't you?
Cambridge is for me both the place I live in reality and an imaginary city. And it's in the imaginary city that people do these foolish things. I've never seen anybody jump the Senate House passage.
But you've heard of it being done.
I've heard of it being done, yes.
And obviously Cambridge is a place full of societies where bets and dares and things like that take place. And this story kicks off with somebody who tries to jump which you've renamed Harley's Folly in the novel, and yet disastrously falls down the gap and dies on the pavement. That's a great starting point. What happens when you create a murder mystery? I mean, the characters, do they take on a kind of human, living, breathing thing for you as a writer?
What happens is that you set them in motion, like the beginning of a game of chess. You put your pieces on the board. Of course, if it's a detective story, you've got to have a plot in mind. If it's a free-running novel, let's say not a detective story of any kind, you can just wait and see what the characters do and let them do it. But if you're writing a detective story, there have to be clues. So you do have to know approximately who is going to murder whom and why before you start, in order to lay the gunpowder trail of clues. So it's slightly mechanical, not in an adverse sense of mechanical, but rather as you might think of the working of a beautiful clock or something. It has to be carefully geared to work properly.
And in Imogen's love life, she is involved with an ageing Don. Tell me about that character.
I'm very interested in everything I write. I'm interested in love, in human affection.
Okay. Yeah.
And the stereotyped love, in which it's always sexual and always between contemporaries, has been very well written about by many a novelist, by many and many and many a novelist. I'm interested in these odd, slightly mismatched occasions when love blossoms.
Yeah.
And Imogen's tenderness for this person she's cared for and helped get better is a perfectly realistic supposition. It's an intellectual friendship based on tender human care. It's one of those situations which we all know in real life, we've all seen it in real life. Where do you find it in literature?
Yeah.
I like trying to find, to write about things which haven't already been done comprehensively by the great writers of the world. And that offbeat, slightly out of time, profound affection is a very, it's an interesting one. I enjoyed writing that.
The story basically also incorporates an Anne Dram production of Shakespeare's Hamlet called The Bad Quarto, where one of the actors deliberately gives clue to the suspected murderer that he knows that this fall from the Senate House leap was not an accident.
There's a mystery in Hamlet, not only in the Bad Quarto version, but in all versions, and that is what the mime is doing.
Yeah.
There's a mime in the middle in which a murder is mimed, and The problem with it is that if the murder is mimed like that, Hamlet is trying to flush out the guilty king by showing what happened. But the problem is it's immediately followed by a play, an Anne Dram play embedded in Hamlet. Why do you need the mime and the play? Now, that's one of those little puzzles in life that I have meditated over while drinking an odd cup of tea for a long time. And I came up with a possible answer, of course, which is embedded in the book.
Why do you think people return again and again to this kind of story? Because they just want more and more of it, don't they?
In one of my other manifestations as a detective story writer, when I'm writing about Peter Wimsey, I wrote, correction, there is a passage in the first Dorothy Sayers completion that I wrote, in which Harriet Vane, who is a detective story writer, diminishes her own work and says, it's not art, is it? And Peter rebukes her and says, what a detective story is a dream of justice. And although it may be a dream and not reality, the world would be a much worse place if people did not hunger and thirst for justice and wish to dream of it. At least it keeps the idea of justice alive. And I think the detective story does do that. It offers you a world in which evil is found out. It's found out by the exercise of intelligence, which particularly in Cambridge is roughly the same thing as goodness.
Yeah.
And its matters are then resolved and put into order. It's the world as it ought to be, and we all wish it were like that. And so I think a detective story is it's like comfort reading for clever people. There are people who read Mills and Boone stories, very sort of predictable love stories for comfort. Round here, people are more likely to want to read an intellectual puzzle. And it's the dream of justice that comforts them and makes them want more and more.
Now, obviously, Dorothy Sayer, an absolutely classic crime writer who created the character of Lord Peter Wimsey. How did your relationship with Dorothy Sayers and continuing her work in the famous Sayers Connection begin? Did you know her well yourself?
I knew her writing well.
I've
been in love with Lord Peter Wimsey since I was 14, and I still am, which is helpful in the situation. I didn't ever meet her personally, although her last surviving real-life friend is still with us. It's Dr. Barbara Reynolds, who is an Italian scholar who helped Sayers finish Dante and who knew her very well. So there's somebody I've been able to talk to who did know her very well.
But she herself was most proud of her translation of Dante's Divine Comedy, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. She was a frustrated scholar. I mean, she wasn't able to pursue scholarship when she was a young woman because she was a vicar's daughter. There wasn't money, and it was very difficult for women to adopt that career in her time. And so she eventually wrote detective stories as a practical way of earning money.
Mm-hmm.
But when, in the war, she took a copy of The Divine Comedy down in Erich Shelter to read, it blew her mind, and she fell in love with Dante and abandoned Lord Peter, leaving an unfinished Lord Peter behind her. She proceeded to concentrate on Dante's scholarship for the rest of her life.
Now, she created, obviously, this well-heeled bachelor gentleman living in London who collects rare books, Lord Peter Wimsey. It's her creation, but she creates all that's best in a gentleman in that character, doesn't she?
Yes, she does. Yeah. She didn't know anything about such people at all.
Yeah.
Well outside her social circle, and she makes a lot of mistakes in the protocol.
Yeah.
But she vividly imagined a man who required an intellectual equal as his consort.
Mm-hmm.
And she vividly imagined that out of need, because in her own life she had a very difficult time with men. And I think he's wish fulfillment, and of course he still is wish fulfillment for large numbers of intelligent women who to this day don't find any too many men who want an intellectual equal as their consort. Some of her and see what they think.
Now, you're given the task of taking up the character of Lord Peter Wimsey and finishing off one of her novels, and then you wrote several more and published most recently The Late Scholar in 2013. What was it like taking on somebody else's work and being expected, meeting the anticipation of the readers to continue a legend like that? Was that difficult?
Well, I think most readers anticipate that you will fail when you do something like that.
So
it's a technical challenge of great interest. I mean, I was offered the job. Phyllis James, P.D. James, having been offered it before me and having said that she thought it wasn't possible. And I think if you imagine yourself as a professional musician and somebody shows you a piece of music and says, can you play that? I mean, you go to the piano and have a shot, don't you? You don't. I was very interested in the technical challenge. Can you, in 1994, complete something abandoned in 1936? And, of course, the first question is, why did she abandon it? Is it booby-trapped in some way? I had to cross the Atlantic and read the papers deposited at Wheaton College, Illinois, which is where some of her papers landed up. And when I found it, it was in a mess. Well, anybody's would be in a mess in that situation. And it took a lot of collating and getting together. I worked out why she had abandoned it, and then I was prepared to have a shot at it. It's not quite as difficult as people think it would be, because any novelist can do various characters. You can't be a novelist if you can't do various characters. The narrative voice is only another character in a novel. So if you must be able to do the narrative voice if you can do the characters. And the other reason why it's not as difficult as people think it might be is because she spoke the King's English. And I was brought up speaking the King's English. So I don't have a great deal of difficulty in imitating her style, which is, in a way, my native tongue.
Is that a bit like kind of art restoration? You have so much of the thing and you have to...
It's very much like art restoration, Well, like art restoration where, say, something like the temple at Knossos, where there are socking great bits of the plaster completely missing. So you carefully restore what's there and then you paint over the blanks in harmony with what's there.
Wimsey finally marries the love of his life, Harriet Vane, in The Late Scholar. And then she takes up a role as the Duchess of Denver.
There are three colleges at least which have a hereditary visitor. And that's an accident in which the constitution has been written to give the name of a duke who happens to be the vice-chancellor at the time, instead of saying the vice-chancellor is the visitor. So then you get a visitorship which goes down the line of dukes, instead of down the line of vice-chancellors. It's happened in both universities. In that case, of course, the Duke of Denver could be a hereditary visitor. And far from Peter being retired from detection, now he's a duke, he finds out suddenly that he has responsibilities for an Oxford college. And the Oxford College in question is reft with conflict because they have a very valuable manuscript, a manuscript of the Boethius, which might have belonged to King Alfred. And they're trying to raise money to buy some land speculatively to make their fortunes for the future. Half the fellowship think it would be a cultural crime to sell the manuscript. The other half are eagerly rubbing their hands and voting to sell it. The vote is evenly split. The warden has a casting vote, but he's disappeared. And suddenly people start being murdered. Each time somebody is murdered, the balance of the vote shifts. So they call for their visitor to come and sort it out for them. And that's the Donne of the book.
It sounds brilliant.
Let me have enormous fun writing about Oxford affectionately. But also the more serious element we were mentioning earlier, writing about late happy marriage. And that's a subject which doesn't infrequently happen in real life. We probably can all sit down and think of several of our friends. But in literature, where is it? Where is it described? I could think of Admiral and Mrs. Croft in Persuasion, and then I stopped. I really can't think of very many literary descriptions of it, so I thought, well, right, I'll fill in this gap. So I've also had fun writing about Peter and Harriet, now many years married, with children at university, applying to university age, and describing that affectionately. So I had a lot of fun writing that book.
Jill Paisley-Walsh, thank you very much indeed for talking to me about your work. It's the most interesting.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Last night, the GradPad in Mill Lane hosted a full house as people flocked to sample a new cabaret club, filling a much-talked-about missing niche in Cambridge's entertainment scene. Creative Cabaret's Lucy Alexander is a founding partner in the club, with Charlotte Sankey of Creative Warehouse, and says it's drawing in people looking for some intelligent action.
Lucy, tell me about yourself and how you got involved in Creative Cabaret. It hasn't been going for very long, has it?
No, it's been going for just over a year, and we've sold out every one of the 7 events. So I moved to Cambridge just over a year ago, not long before we started Creative Cabaret. I knew Charlotte from London from years ago when we worked together in a big NGO in London. I'd only been here 6 weeks, and she said, did I want to meet for a coffee, and did I want to hear about her new idea and see if I wanted to be involved? And she told me, she said, I've had this idea, this is exactly what Cambridge needs. It's, you know, in Cambridge you can go to a gig any night of the week, a classical concert any night of the week, a play, you can hear academics speaking, all of these things, but that's only one thing at a time. And I want to put on a cabaret, which is like a review, and where you can get lots of different things in one evening. It's exciting to have launched this event, which keeps selling out.
How many people in a sold-out event are coming to an event like that?
It's 200. So the cabarets are held at the University Centre near Scudamore's in Mill Lane, Grantor Place. About 200.
You're doing mixed arts forms, music, poetry, films, philosophy, comedy, and even magic, I hear.
And mime. We have a brilliant magician who works the tables. We have academics. For example, we've got FameLab scientists who are Cambridge graduates giving 3-minute talks about one of their pet subjects. We have, as you say, poetry, philosophy, mime, comedy, music, magic, film, and photography as well.
Take me through the evening that's just gone.
We've had Sindhu V, she was a finalist for Funny Women, and she came up from London and it has a very funny take on living with an Indian mother and yet being a modern woman in Britain. For example, her mother, when she discovered that she came out about smoking, and her mother said, well, you must be a lesbian then. Have had Polly Paulsma, we've had her twice now. She is a Cambridge singer-songwriter, very, very talented, writes beautiful songs and has a wonderful voice. The band we've had this time is also Cambridge, very Mill Road based. In fact, Polly's just round the corner from the radio station too. So it's lovely finding new Cambridge talent, as well as having people from London.
And tell me about Charlotte Sankey. What does she do? What's her role in it?
She will compare, and it was her idea, because she's lived in Cambridge for 15 years. And in fact, when I last worked with her was when she just moved to Cambridge and I was living in Hertfordshire, and she launched a magazine called Cambridge Agenda. And then that went on to be very successful. So she loves launching new ideas, basically.
Is there any opportunity to see sort of artwork connected to a cabaret, like sort of Romy Schneider's film posters and things like that?
At the February Cabaret, we have a screen as our backdrop, and on it, in the intervals, we had rotating sculptures, pictures of sculptures. Yeah. This time what we've done is filmed some of the performers, and we're going to put snippets on YouTube. Each performer has their slot of anything between 3 and 20 minutes. And if they're a poet, they'll be reading their work. If they're a singer-songwriter, they'll be singing their work. It's not a burlesque cabaret. There's one of those in Cambridge already, and we don't want to tread on their toes.
Yeah.
And also, that's not what what Creative Cabaret is about. It's about the arts, the performing arts. Please book for the next cabaret in June via our website, which is creativecabaretcambridge.co.uk. Tickets available online or come around to the office at 7 Downing Place. And also do look for us on YouTube, because we're about to put up some of the highlights from last night's cabaret, and we would love as many people as possible to have a look.
Sounds absolutely fantastic. Lucy Alexander, thank you very much indeed for telling one about it.
This week has seen the 450th anniversary of William Shakespeare's birthday, and across the country, theatres have been celebrating the Bard's dramatic genius in no small measure. As we heard earlier in the programme, a shortened version of Hamlet, normally a 4.5-hour play, called The Bad Quarto, playing a key part in a murder mystery, exploiting Hamlet's father's ghost to further a deadly plot. Well, a fascination with Hamlet is enduring, as I heard from local playwright Ronnie Drew, who's had a go at her own shortened Hamlet in 3 acts, turning it around to deliver a feminist take on Hamlet, and she's also created 2 other works inspired by Shakespeare, staged earlier this week in Cambridge. She dropped into 105 to talk on Shakespeare Reformed.
Rani, once again, your usual skill is to take something we know and turn it on its head as a starting point for some drama.
Yes, and I enjoy that, and nothing better than that.
Where did the idea come from to commit such sacrilege as to rewrite or reuse word the work of the Bard?
These plays were written in Hungary around mid-90s, and I just, because Shakespeare is more of a Bard in Hungary than he is in Britain, and they call him Shakespeare Bachi, Shakespeare Uncle, and the National Theatre is absolutely, you know, he's almost a national poet and dramatist for them. So I thought, well, I need to knock that down and start with, you know, showing up some of the things which, you know, of course, any playwright writes what he or she wants to, so there is no quibble of that with Shakespeare, but the treatment of the Queen, who was actually quite faultless, this is in Hamlet, and Ophelia, who was really quite nice, innocent person, she was absolutely ravished by, you know, criticism and anger and wrath you know, doing things, you know, that weren't nice, gentle. And so I thought, well, I ought to... Well, basically, it wasn't even that. It was that nobody actually has worked out what was the trouble with Hamlet. Because if you perform Hamlet, full Hamlet of Shakespeare's, it takes about 4.5 hours. And it's very, very long. That's why it is often cut down and performed. And I thought, well, I'll cut it down and then I will add to it another perspective. Maybe women can tell more about what was wrong with Hamlet. That wasn't the problem that Shakespeare had set out to find. But I think there is a motive behind the whole thing, that Hamlet was a university man. He had gone to university along with Fortinbras. So there are 2 kingdoms. One is Norway and one is Denmark. And both, there are 2 young men who are going to get the throne. But there is a contrast between them, which doesn't really come out too clearly for people who can't understand Shakespeare that quickly.
So you've managed to boil it down into 3 acts.
Yes.
And what have you... first of all, you must have taken away masses and selected the situations that you want to be concerned with. But that must have been a terribly difficult task to try and do that.
Well, in a way, it wasn't, because what I did was I've only added 15 pages in prologue and epilogue, and a prologue for each act of Shakespeare, and then an epilogue at the end. So what I'm doing is I'm getting Ophelia back, because she dies in Act 4 of Shakespeare, and I use that scene for the first prologue. I show her death, and then I show that her ghost comes back. So this is balancing the ghost of Shakespeare, Hamlet's father.
You employ prologues and epilogues in most of the things that you do, don't don't you? Because basically you use them to explain to the audience what it is you're driving at.
In yes, of your, and Shakespeare does use it in this technique in certain plays, and I can't remember now what. So I have taken it from his plays and used it. So with getting Ophelia's ghost back, I make Ophelia look at Hamlet and say what was wrong with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that he, in a Freudian way, it turns out that he was father-oriented. He didn't become, he didn't have the same problem as the Oedipus complex. He didn't marry his mother, but he rubbished her. Mm. And this was, and also he became hateful towards Ophelia because he set out to take revenge of his father's death,
There are only two women in the play, obviously Gertrudis and Ophelia. Are you slightly annoyed that there weren't more women?
No.
We talked the other day about, you were saying that you look at Shakespeare's women and each of them have different attributes and different things, and obviously the more women that he does, the more you can see into his mind and look at it critically.
Yes, you can't be critical of people if they use one woman. I mean, myself, in the last play, Unsung Heroine of the Double Helix, I had one woman and six men. So I don't think that matters so much. What matters is that these women in Elizabethan time, and I think some of the things are still happening, people haven't been able to work out what was his problem. Mm-hmm. Why did he go on and on? And from the Freudian point of view, it is that he actually went to the father's side and became anti his mother. And Ophelia says, look, I will show you what your problem is. You have worked out a play to find out the conscience of the king. I will also enact a play which will show what was your trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Because your father turned up and called you to himself and told the girl to go away.
Mm.
And this gender split in the children, the son goes to the father and the daughter goes to the mother.
Was it difficult for these? I mean, there are only a few male actors. Obviously, the cast had the two women, Hamlet, his father's ghost, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Did the actors have a lot of fun with the project? And was it really difficult for them to understand how you had altered the exchanges between the characters?
It wasn't, because don't forget that although I altered the perspective of the play, but Hamlet, Shakespeare's three acts of Hamlet remained intact. Nothing was deleted.
Mm.
Nothing was taken out, because my purpose was to say everything
using his beautiful language.
Yes, and also show a different perspective on it. And of course, his fourth act, I turned into a prologue, the first one, Ophelia's death and other things, but I didn't use all of it. Mm. And the last one, I just shortened it, turned it into an epilogue.
Okay, now the second one is called Shakespeare and Me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about two Hungarian actresses called Agnes and Eva who are involved in acting in a Shakespeare play. Now, what happens in that one?
Okay, first thing is that one is Hungarian, Eva is Hungarian, but Agnes is English. She actually went from Britain to teach in Hungary. But the characters are Hungarian. So what happens there is that the national, I don't know whether the National Theatre here has exams, but you can sit for four exams for admission into the National Theatre. So Agnes, the feminist woman, she's failed three times and she's got just one chance. And she says, I'm going to do whatever I want. You know, if I fail, then I've at least, had enjoyment of bashing at them. So she takes about eight pieces from Shakespeare. One is a sonnet on love, and she brings the female element into it. Then she has won the Seven Ages of Man. And, why didn't he write Seven Ages of Woman? So she does Seven Ages of Woman. And then she does Desdemona. She does Taming of the Shrew and Lady Macbeth.
Mm.
And, I recently saw, at the Picture House, this sort of relayed performance in London of the Taming of the Shrew. It was horrific. Mm. It was overplayed, absolutely overplayed. And so I, again, look at it, why was she like that?
So you want people to take more imagination in the development of the roles of women. That's what you're looking
absolutely.
At.
Yes, absolutely. And Shakespeare is littered with Lady Macbeth. You know, the blame of all the murders that, that Macbeth committed are put on Lady Macbeth.
Finally, the last piece centres on the character of Caliban from The Tempest. What is it that you do with Caliban? He's the enslaved and ugly servant to Prospero, isn't
he? Yes, yes. Now, this is a sort of colonisation play, and I put it on its head again, and I show post-colonisation. So, in The Tempest, Prospero and all the thing, they think, they land on this island, and there's nobody there. Apart from Ariel, they catch Ariel and they catch Caliban. And Caliban is an ugly sort of, you know, man, and Ariel is a beautiful person. He's the spirit and Caliban is the body. So
Okay, you've hijacked that and you've reworked it, but into what?
Absolutely, into a reality of what colonies were when the British went there, colonized it, said they're all savages, and it turned out they were not savages. In order to protect the island and the people on the island, Caliban's mother put a magic on everybody on the island so they will not enslave anyone there. But Ariel, who was sort of, you know, into the tree, the magic didn't work on him, and on Caliban half changed. So that's why they were. And you know, in Shakespeare's play, neither Ariel nor Caliban ever meet each other. And this is the colonial policy of the British to keep people apart.
Great stuff, Ronnie Tree. Thank you very much indeed for coming to talk about your plays. They're always interesting.
Well, thank you very much, Simon, for interviewing me once more.
It's time to take a peek at what's coming up in the city in the next few weeks. If you're listening to the rerun of the show, this will be out of date. Singer Neil Finn takes the stage at the Corn Exchange on Sunday the 4th of May as part of his 2014 Dizzy Heights album tour. Work by artist Ian Rawlinson goes on show at a new exhibition entitled Vessel at Williams Art in Gwydir Street on May the 7th and runs until the 1st of June. A new version of the provocative play Spring Awakening by Frank Wedekind in 1906 opens at the Arts Theatre on Tuesday, April the 29th, exploring the world of youth cause riots, partly rewritten and modernised by playwright Anya Rice. That's followed by 90s play The Things We Do for Love by Alan Eichborn at the Arts Theatre on May the 5th. A bedroom farce develops between two shared house neighbours with politics that clash. On April 27th, the Cambridge Classical Concert Series continues with the Basel Symphony Orchestra at the Corn Exchange, with conductor Dennis Russell Davis and cellist Matt Horowitz playing work by influential 20th century composers Arvo Pärt, Philip Glass and John Adams. Cockney songstress Pamela Faith opens at the Corn Exchange on May the 24th, featuring hits from her new album, A Perfect Contradiction. And that's all we have time for in this edition of Arts Roundup. I hope you've enjoyed listening in on Cambridge 105 and will tell us about your creative stories.